Chapter 13. Law, Legends and Truth. The Foundation Legends. Any self-respecting city has to have a legend about its own foundation. Ankh-Morpork, as is right and proper for the oldest and greatest city on the disc, has two. The first is the official one. According to this, there were once two orphaned brothers, mere babies, who had been left on the shores of the Ankh to die. There they were found by a she-hippopotamus, who suckled them. When they grew up, they decided to build themselves a home, and so founded what must at the time have been a very small city indeed. In memory of this, the shield on the coat of arms of Ankh-Morpork has, as its supporters, deux hippopotames royales béantes, un enchaîné, un couronné au cou, which, stripped of its aristocratic herald speak, means two royal hippos yawning, one wearing a chain and the other with a crown round its neck. The conventions of heraldry do not permit the sex of the beasts to be clearly indicated, but in view of the tale, we can safely state that at least one of them is female. The legend is also commemorated by eight hippo statues on the city's brass bridge facing out to sea. It is said that if danger ever threatens the city, they will run away. Some people have expressed doubts over this ancient and uplifting tradition. Why and how, they ask, would a she-hippo suckle human babies? And how could they thrive on this eccentric diet? Did they but know it, these doubters could find a tale on Earth proving that such things are perfectly possible. It tells of twins, Romulus and Remus, who were the sons of Mars, the god of war, and a human princess. Their evil great-uncle, having just usurped his brother's throne, seized the boys and threw them into the Tiber for fear they might grow up to challenge him. Tyrants insist on doing this, despite the fact that it never works. But the river washed them safely to the bank, where a she-wolf fed them with her milk until a kindly shepherd found them. Later, they built the city of Rome. Considering what wolves normally eat, this tale is even more wondrous than that of the hippo, but the Romans had no difficulty in believing it, and, naturally, making a statue about it. The second legend is not told quite so often by the citizens of Ankh-Morpork, but is surprisingly widespread in other towns. It is said that way back in the fogs of time, there was once a great flood sent by the gods, and that a group of wise men survived by building a huge boat, into which they crammed two of every type of animal then existing on the disc. After a few weeks, the combined manure was beginning to weigh the boat low in the water. So, the story runs, they tipped it over the side and called the heap Ankh-Morpork. Anybody who doubts the truth of this should go and stand on one of the bridges over the Ankh, preferably on a warm day, and breathe deep. Sunken Cities and Vanishing Islands. There is also the legend of the Lost City, the city before the city. It is not an uncommon tale. Indeed, there are variants in all the cities of the Stowe Plains, but hardly anyone takes it seriously. There had been a city once, in the mists of prehistory, bigger than Ankh-Morpork, if that were possible, and the inhabitants had done something, some sort of unspeakable crime, not just against mankind or the gods, but against the very nature of the universe itself, which had been so dreadful that it had sunk beneath the sea one stormy night. Only a few people had survived to carry to the barbarian peoples in the less advanced parts of the disc all the arts and crafts of civilization. From Moving Pictures. According to the dreaded grimoire Necrotelecomnicon, there had been a hill at the edge of the city. And in that hill, it is said, a door out of the world was found. And people of the city watched what was seen therein, knowing not the dread waited between the universes, for others found the gate of the holy wood, and fell upon the world, and in one night all manner of madness befell, and chaos prevailed, and the city sank beneath the sea, and all became one with the fishes and the lobsters, save for a few who fled. The hill is still there, on a lonely stretch of coast about 30 miles from Ankh Morpork. It is not very high, yet high enough to be visible for miles, standing out from the wind-blown sand dunes all around. It is covered with wretched, scrubby trees. People call it Holy Wood. And they say that if you stand on the beach at Holy Wood on a stormy night, you can still hear the bells of old temples ringing under the sea. The events chronicled in moving pictures would suggest that there is, after all, rather more than a grain of truth in these old tales. There are many, many legends about sunken cities on Earth, where islands bob up and down like the chorus in HMS Pinafore. The oldest on record was told by the Greek philosopher Plato about 2,400 years ago, and according to him, it was true, and had happened some 9,000 years before that. And it was not just one city that had sunk, but the whole large island of Atlantis, rich, civilized, with many mighty cities, harbors, and palaces. There, men had at first been wise and virtuous, but in time, they became obsessed with wealth and power, so the gods destroyed their land in a single day and night. There occurred portentous earthquakes and floods, and one grievous day and night befell them, when the whole body of warriors was swallowed up by the earth, and the island of Atlantis in like manner was swallowed up by the sea and vanished. Wherefore also, the ocean at that spot has now become impassable and unsearchable, being blocked up by the shoal of mud which the island created as it settled down. Plato, Timaeus, translated by R. G. Berry. Plato does not mention any door or gate, for the large-scale destruction he describes must have involved some great natural disaster, an earthquake, a volcanic eruption, a tsunami, and was the direct work of the gods. There are other more recent traditions along the sea coasts of Western Europe, telling of lands and towns submerged by the foolish or treacherous act of someone who opened a sluice gate. In Wales, for instance, they talk of the lost land of Cantrea Gwaelod, under the waters of Cardigan Bay. 40 miles long by 20 wide it was, with 16 fine towns on it. There was a great dike protecting it from the sea, but Seithenhin, the keeper of the dike, was a drunkard, and one night forgot to close the sluice gates. The way others tell it, Seithenhin was lord of the land, and it was his daughter who let in the sea, curses upon her. Or it was God's doing, because Seithenhin was a proud and presumptuous ruler. Whatever, you can still see the pebble ridge which was once the protecting wall. You can still hear bells ringing underwater. Then there is the Breton tale of the drowning of Caer Is. This, they say, was a magnificent city built on land reclaimed from the sea in what is now the Bay of Dornane in Brittany, and ruled by a king Gralon of Gradlon. He himself was a virtuous man, but his courtiers and subjects were drunken and debauched, though a holy man warned them that there would be a reckoning. After happiness, grief. Anyone who eats the meat of the fish, by the fish he will be eaten, and anyone who swallows will be swallowed, and anyone who drinks wine and mead will drink water like a fish, and anyone who doesn't know will learn. Livarden Gerris, translated by James Doane. Yet the king let the revellers go on feasting, while he took himself quietly to bed. Now the king had a daughter named Dahut, and she had a lover, some say he was the devil himself, but they always say that sort of thing, who coaxed her into stealing the golden key which her father wore on a chain round his neck as he slept. This was the key to the gate in the dikes, protecting the city from the sea. They were opened, and the ocean swept in and submerged everything. Only Gralon himself escaped, thanks to the saint's warning and to his fine horse. Dahut tried to mount behind him, but the saint miraculously appeared and struck her with his crozier, so that she fell into the raging waters and drowned. As for the sunken city, its buildings can sometimes be glimpsed when the sea is calm and clear, and its bells are heard ringing. Legend loves the sound of sunken bells. In Cornwall, tradition tells of the lost land of Lyoness, which once stretched all the way from Land's End to the Scilly Isles, though no one now remembers just why it sank. The strange rocky outcrop of St. Michael's Mount overlooks Mount's Bay, where the lost land once began, and where one can still, at very low tides, find fossilized bits of wood from the trees which once grew there. In the Cornish language, 400 years ago, the mount was called Carrack Luz on Coos, the grey rock in the wood. The drowned forest was important once. Maybe it was a holy wood. Such legends have always been particularly popular among fishermen. They are the ones who, peering down through unusually clear water, sometimes glimpse curious structures that look more like streets and ruined buildings than simple rocks. They are the ones whose nets sometimes snag on underwater obstacles where, according to their charts, no obstacles should be. Oddly, the fishermen of Ankh Morpork do not have such legends. So it came as a total surprise to Solid Jackson and his son, out fishing by night in the middle of the Circle Sea, when a sound came from below the surface, the sound of a bell or gong slowly swinging, followed by a weathercock, a tower, a surge of huge, weed-encrusted buildings, a whole malevolent-looking city on an oozy, weedy island, rising up out of the sea. They had discovered the lost island and city of Leshp. They did not like it. In fact, it gave them the willies. Partly this was because of the smell of sulphur and rotting seaweed, partly because of nasty little ripples and soft splashing noises in the dark pools that lingered in the deeper cellars. But mainly it was because of the city itself. There were some buildings which looked more or less as human buildings should, with pillars and arches and steps and such like, and nice tiled floors with patterns of shells and squid and octopuses. But besides these, there were the remains of massive structures which had nothing to do with human architecture. It came as a relief when the island, after a few weeks, settled back down onto the seabed. Some faint awareness of these events, chronicled in Jingo, may have reached parts of the earth. There is talk there of a green land of enchantment, which occasionally rises to the surface in the Bristol Channel, and then vanishes again. A certain Captain Jones had a curious experience in the 1890s, which was reported in the Pembroke County Guardian. Once, when trending up the Bristol Channel and passing Grassholm Island in what he had always known as deep water, he was surprised to see, to windward of him, a large tract of land covered with a beautiful green meadow. It was not, however, above water, but just a few feet below, say 2 or 3, so that the grass waved and swam about as the ripple flowed over it, in a way quite delightful to the eye, so that as one watched, it made one feel quite drowsy. "You know," he continued, "I have heard old people say there is a floating island off there that sometimes rises to the surface, more nearly, and then sinks down again fathoms deep, so that no one sees it for years, and when nobody expects it, comes up again for a while. How it may be, I do not know, but that is what they say." There are similar tales of intermittent islands off the coast of Norway and Ireland. If you want to make them stay permanently above water, since they offer good grazing, the thing to do is to throw a knife or a burning torch or a lit tobacco pipe onto them before they can sink again, but this is very hard to achieve. The largest and loveliest Norwegian one is called Utrust, inhabited by kindly beings. It only becomes visible to humans if their lives are in deadly danger, when its harbour offers them safety. Those who shelter there would have good luck all their lives. These are nice islands, of course, even if they are imaginary. One that was undoubtedly real and very Leshpian in its effects appeared in July 1831. It was a pumice island, and it rose to the surface off the coast of Sicily due to volcanic action. A British fleet landed on it and claimed it for Britain, naming it Graham Island. But the Italians also claimed it, naming it Ferdinandia. The French and Spaniards showed interest too, The ensuing diplomatic dispute was still not settled when the island sank back into the sea in December of the same year, which was rather a shame, but averted a possible war. Finally, it should be noted that an island which pops up and then sinks again is, as Leonard of Querm remarked, rather like a certain type of folklore current among sailors on the Discworld. "It puts me in mind," said Leonard, "of those nautical stories of giant turtles that sleep on the surface, thus causing sailors to think they are an island. Of course, you don't get giant turtles that small." From Jingo. In our world, in the absence of any turtles larger than, say, a decent-sized dining table, traditional nautical lore warns instead of the risks involved in landing on a really, really big fish or whale, which happens to be dozing on the surface. In particular, it is very unwise to light a small fire and start cooking breakfast. St. Brendan the Navigator, who was abbot of Clonfert in Ireland in the 6th century, is said to have done just that while sailing far out in the Atlantic. Suddenly, what he thought was an island began to twitch, and then to sink. Brendan and his crew were lucky to get back to their ship in time. Exactly the same thing happened to Sinbad the Sailor on his first voyage in the Indian Ocean, as is told in The Thousand and One Nights. The ship came to a little island, which seemed as fair as the Garden of Eden, where the passengers disembarked. Some wandered off to explore, while others busied themselves cooking, eating, and drinking. "While we were thus engaged, we suddenly heard the captain cry out to us from the ship, 'All aboard, quickly! Abandon everything and run for your lives! The mercy of Allah be upon you, for this is no island, but a gigantic whale floating on the bosom of the sea, on whose back the sands have settled and trees have grown, since the world was young. When you lit the fire, it felt the heat and stirred. Make haste, I say, for soon the whale will plunge into the sea, and you will all be lost.'" Translated by N.J. Darwood. According to the poet Milton, the enormous creature is none other than Leviathan, mentioned in the Bible. That sea beast Leviathan, which God of all his works created hugest, that swim the ocean stream, him, haply slumbering on the Norway foam, the pilot of some small night-foundered skiff, deeming some island, oft, as seamen tell, with fixed anchor in his scaly rind, moors by his side under the lee, while night invests the sea, and wished morn delays. Atlantic, Indian Ocean, seas off Norway, the monster or the story certainly does get around. In Cambridge University Library, and in the British Library, there are manuscripts of a Latin bestiary, that is, a book of beasts, dating from the early 12th century. It includes a section about the sea monster which gets mistaken for an island, beginning thus: "There is an ocean monster which is called an Aspido Delone in Greek. On the other hand, it is called an Aspido Testudo in Latin. It is also called a whale. This animal lifts its back out of the open sea above the watery waves." Translated by T.H. White. Testudo is Latin for tortoise. Delone makes no sense, and must be a mistake for chelone, which is indeed a Greek word meaning turtle. Why on earth should English monks 1,000 years ago get the traditional whale mixed up with tortoises and turtles? Some echo from the Discworld, maybe. As for Aspido, this must refer to a snake of some sort, so it would seem that the sea serpent has somehow got into the mix. It makes a good yarn, even better. Kings and Heroes. A certain legendary glow surrounds the rather vague memory of the Kings of Ankh, a dynasty which came to an end some 2,000 years ago. They are said to have been thoroughly wise, just, charismatic, and so on, plus being, of course, extremely powerful. As for the later Kings of Ankh-Morpork, they are remembered in many a merry anecdote for recurrent lunacy, sadistic cruelty, and general bloody-mindedness. These anecdotes, being factually accurate, do not count as folklore. If a ruler made himself too disagreeable to the rest of the aristocracy, the Guild of Assassins would eventually be contacted, and he would be discreetly inhumed. Curiously, this tactful and civilized procedure is seen by some as the survival of something extremely archaic. There was a tradition once, far back in the past, called the King of the Bean. A special dish was served to all the men of the clan on a certain day of the year. It contained one small, hard-baked bean, and whoever got the bean was, possibly after some dental attention, hailed as king. It was quite an inexpensive system, and it worked well, possibly because the clever little bald men who actually ran things and paid some attention to possible candidates were experts at palming a bean into the right bowl. And while the crops ripened, and the tribe thrived, and the land was fertile, the king thrived too. But when, in the fullness of time, crops failed, and the ice came back, and animals were inexplicably barren, the clever little bald men sharpened their long knives, which were mostly used for cutting mistletoe. And on the dew night, one of them went into his cave and carefully baked one small bean. Of course, that was before people were civilized. These days, no one has to eat beans. From Night Watch. That, at any rate, is a theory of kingship put forward by speculative folklorists in Ankh-Morpork, and enthusiastically adopted by people who feel tradition must always be bloodthirsty or about sex, or, preferably, both. Naturally, when dealing with such a remote period, one can't expect to find documentary evidence to back up one's hypothesis. Cave-dwelling clans don't keep diaries or committee minutes. But quoth the raven, who is a member of an occult species with links to the gods, and therefore knows what he's talking about, does mention a midwinter custom thousands of years ago, which sounds rather similar. It involved some poor bugger finding a special bean in his food at the Hog's Watch feast. It made him king, but also meant he'd be killed off a few days later. A merry reign, but a short one. We have more to say about this in the section on the Hogfather. To return to the early kings of Ankh. Theirs was a golden age, from which little remains. Some well-built ancient sewers, a few ruined walls, a worm-eaten throne, and, if legend can be believed, a very special sword. Nobody has set eyes on it for centuries, and many think it must be lost. And yet, there are always rumours. Although they are so proud of being modern and living in an age of reason, the citizens of Ankh-Morpork have surprisingly romantic imaginations. Their minds are littered with mangled myths and fragmented fairy tales. Deep down, they feel sure that one day a long-lost heir will turn up, brandishing the sword and displaying a birthmark to claim the throne. He will right all wrongs, and the golden age will return. Since the rules of fairy tale narrative are known to every child in the multiverse, even in worlds where the books of Grimm and Andersen are not to be found, the people of Ankh-Morpork naturally assume that the heir will have begun life as a humble swineherd, and/or revived a princess who has been asleep for 100 years, and/or proved how royal he is by sleeping on a huge pile of mattresses and a few very small peas. His hands will have sensational but highly specialized healing powers, though there appears to be some uncertainty about what exactly it is that he cures. Some citizens think a true king can cure baldness by his touch, while the aristocratic Lord Rust mentions dandruff and scrofula, a disease of the throat glands. On Earth, it was definitely scrofula, which was therefore known as King's Evil. Several kings of England, from the time of Edward the Confessor to the end of the Stuart dynasty, made a point of ceremonially touching sufferers. So did the kings of France. Best of all, if the heir to a kingdom encounters a dragon, he will most certainly slay it. As cut-me-own-throat Dibbler says to the sceptical Vimes, "You've got no romance in your soul, Captain. When a stranger comes into the city under the thrall of the dragon and challenges it with a glittery sword, well, there's only one outcome, ain't there? It's probably destiny." from God's guards. In the same way, people know just how things will go if a dragon appears. It will fly around, flaming and ravening. It will want a pile of gold to sleep on. It will expect people to give it virgins to eat, chained to rocks. It will speak, quite likely, in riddles. But it will have one vulnerable spot, which a good archer can hit as it flies overhead. That's what always happened in the old stories, and so that's what will happen again. These expectations are moulded by all the dragon lore which has been drifting from one universe to another from the dawn of time. There is no mythology in any world which doesn't have dragons in it, together with gods or heroes to kill them. The tales known in Ankh-Morpork are just as famous on Earth. There, it was the ancient Greek hero Perseus who was the first to rescue a virgin, who had been left chained to a rock for a dragon to eat. Her name was Andromeda. Later, St. George did the same, though he, being a saint, didn't marry the girl. Several great warriors of Anglo-Saxon and Scandinavian legend, Beowulf, for instance, and the two Volsung heroes, Sigmund and Sigurd, whom Germans call Siegfried, slew dragons which lay on hoards of treasure. One of these, the one named Fafner, which Sigurd killed, did indeed speak, and could ask and answer riddles. As for the one vulnerable spot, this is sometimes on the belly, as it was with Fafner, and with Smaug in the tale of Bilbo the Hobbit. More often, it is when a dragon opens his mouth that he becomes vulnerable to a well-aimed spear or arrow, going down his gullet and into his vitals. This technique was pioneered by the Babylonian god Marduk, who destroyed the primeval dragoness Tiamat by hurling deadly winds down her throat. And then there is the sad case of the Yorkshire dragon of Wantley, whom Moore, of Moore Hall, kicked in the arsehole with a spiked boot.
"Murder! Murder!" the dragon cried. "Alack, alack for grief! Had you but missed that place, you could have done me no mischief." Then his head he shaked, trembled and quaked, and down he laid and cried. First on one knee, then on back tumbled he, so groaned, kicked, shat, and died.
It's the little details that charm. Some more legends. Many town dwellers have, lurking in the corners of their minds, various half-remembered tales and no longer properly believed beliefs, which pop up again in the right circumstances. The tale of the shifting shop, for instance. Glod looked up at a blank wall.
"I knew it," he said. "Didn't I say? Magic! How many times have we heard this story? There's a mysterious shop no one's ever seen before, and someone goes in and buys some rusty old curio, and it turns out to, Glod, some kind of talisman or a bottle full of genie. And then, when there's trouble, they go back and the shop, Glod, has mysteriously disappeared and gone back to whatever dimension it came from. Yes, what is it?" "You're on the wrong side of the road. It's over here."
From Soul Music. But in fact, Glod was right. The shop was magic, and contained, among other things, a flute, which you mustn't blow unless you want to be knee-deep in rats, a trumpet, which can make the world end and the sky fall down, and a gong, which can make 777 skeletal warriors spring up out of the earth. Two out of the three would work on Earth, too, not the gong, since according to Greek myth, the correct way to make warriors spring up out of the earth is to sow the ground with dragon's teeth, as the heroes Cadmus and Jason did. But the Bible does mention a last trump, with which, according to prophecy, an angel will announce that doomsday has come. And the flute is clearly a pair to the fife with which the Pied Piper of Hamelin summoned rats. The Hamelin story is a fine example of the weird power of narrativium. It seems reasonably certain that something did happen in the German town of Hamelin in 1284. something involving a stranger and the children of the town, and that everyone found it very upsetting. There are sober, reliable chronicles written less than 100 years after the event, which declare that someone marched into the town on the 26th of June in 1284 and marched away with 130 of its children. But they do not say anything about rats, or a pipe, or curiously coloured clothes. In fact, there's no magic involved at all. He marches in, he marches away, taking the children. That's all there is to it, at first. But that won't do. Surely, people thought, something so terrible as the loss of all those children must have more to it than that. It must be due to sorcery, or a punishment for some sin, or both. Now, it was widely believed throughout Europe that some men had an uncanny power over snakes or rats or mice. They would summon the vermin by playing on a flute or pipe, and then lead them into deep water, or order them to leap into a bonfire, and so destroy them all. Perhaps a man who could lure rats could also lure children. Could one of these legendary rat catchers have come to Hamelin in great-great-grandfather's time? Could something have angered him? Maybe the townsfolk tried to cheat him of his pay, and he took his revenge. And so the story of the Pied Piper was born. Back in 1284, people said the town had been overrun with rats, until a stranger arrived, proclaiming himself a rat catcher. He was dressed in a multicoloured coat and carried a small fife, so they called him the Pied Piper, and promised him a great deal of money if he would help them. As soon as he started playing, rats came running out of every house and followed him as he marched out of town. He led them down to the river Weser and waded in. They followed and drowned. But then the citizens regretted having promised so much money, so they made excuses not to pay, and he went off in a furious rage. On the 26th of June, he returned, this time dressed as a hunter. Again he played his fife, but this time it was children who came running to him, and he led them out of the town, where they disappeared with him into a cave in a mountain, and were never seen again. Though some said they came out alive hundreds of miles away in Transylvania. By the middle of the 16th century, this had become the official explanation. The mayor had the entire story illustrated in stained glass windows in the main church. A new city gate erected in 1556 carried an inscription stating that it was put up 272 years after the sorcerer abducted 130 children. Another inscription on the city hall commemorated 130 children lost by a piper inside a mountain. Of course, there are always some people who prefer a rational explanation to a magical one. With the Hamelin story, it's not difficult to think of something that could fit, and many modern commentators have offered suggestions. There were wars going on in 13th century Germany, so maybe a recruiting sergeant passed through the town and led away 130 young men, and maybe they were all killed in battle. Or maybe the date is wrong, and the story really recalls how friars came preaching wild sermons to get youngsters to join the so-called Children's Crusade to Jerusalem in 1212. They never got there, and those who did not die on the road ended up as slaves. Or maybe it refers to the forced emigration of local families to colonize new territories far away. For example, Bishop Bruno of Olmutz recruited families from Lower Saxony to build up a German population in his diocese in Bohemia. A comparison of city records in Hamelin and Olmutz reveals a startling agreement in the family names in each place, which bears out the rumour that the lost children of Hamelin reappeared safe and sound in Transylvania. Be that as it may, it's the rats, the pipe, and the pied coat that we remember now, and only a beastly spoilsport would point out that rats can swim. As for drums, there was even an Ankh-Morpork legend, wasn't there, about some old drum in the palace, or somewhere that was supposed to bang itself if an enemy fleet was seen sailing up the Ankh. The legend had died out in recent centuries, partly because this was the age of reason,
and also because no enemy fleet could sail up the Ankh without a gang of men with shovels going in front. From Soul Music. There is a curiously close parallel here with the patriotic English legends of Drake's Drum. After the great Elizabethan seaman Sir Francis Drake died off Panama in 1595, a drum, painted with his coat of arms, was brought back to his home at Buckland Abbey in Devon, and is still kept there. It is traditionally believed to have come from the ship on which he had once sailed round the world. In 1895, for the 300th anniversary of the hero's death, Sir Henry Newbolt wrote a vigorous poem telling how Drake on his deathbed promised that if the drum was struck when England was in danger, he would return to save the country once again, as he had done when the Spanish Armada came.
Drake, he was a Devon man, and ruled the Devon seas. Captain, art thou sleeping there below? Roving though his death fell, he went with heart at ease, and dreaming all the time of Plymouth Hoe. Take my drum to England, hang it by the shore, strike it when your powder's running low. If the Dons sight Devon, I'll quit the port of heaven, and drum them up the channel, as we drummed them long ago.
In 1916, when England was at war, a poet named Alfred Noyes gave this story an even stronger patriotic twist. Writing an article in the Times about submarine warfare, he declared that Devon fishermen believed that the drum had sounded of its own accord in times of crisis, and the Drake would always hear and answer its call. It had been heard when Nelson's fleet went to meet the French at Trafalgar, and again in that very year of 1916, before the naval battle of Jutland in the North Sea. And this, the fishermen said, showed that Drake had returned to inspire Nelson and Admiral Jellicoe, and guide them to victory. Whether Noyes really had heard Devon fishermen saying this, or whether he had made it up himself, hardly matters. It's folklore now. And now people say Drake's drum was heard in 1940, at the evacuation of Dunkirk. The citizens of Ankh Morpork show in their legends an appreciation of virtue, which is rarely evident in their lives. They can, in fact, be downright sentimental. Take the story of the famous dog Gaspode, not to be confused with the mangy, flea-ridden, speaking cur of the same name, who was simply called after him. The reason the famous Gaspode is famous is his devotion to his master.
"It was years and years ago. There was this old bloke in Ankh who snuffed it, and he belonged to one of them religions where they bury you after you're dead, and they did. And he had this old dog..."
"Called Gaspode?"
"Yeah, and this old dog had been his only companion, and after they buried the man, he lay down on his grave and howled for a couple of weeks, growled at everybody who came near, and then died."
From Moving Pictures. Strangely, there are two cities on Earth, Edinburgh and Tokyo, where almost the same story is told, the main difference being that the dog survives for many years, fed by passers-by, though still faithfully grieving. In Edinburgh, this model of doggy devotion is a terrier called Greyfriars Bobby, after the graveyard where his master, a night watchman called John Grey, was buried in 1858, and where there is now a statue of him. The dog, that is, not John Grey. He lived on for 14 years. Some say he spent all day at his master's grave, but others say he was regularly fed in a nearby restaurant. When he died, a place was found for him near the entrance of Greyfriars Kirkyard, though not actually in consecrated ground. The stone is inscribed, "Let his loyalty and devotion be a lesson to us all." In Tokyo, the faithful dog named Hachiko used to go daily to Shibuya Station to meet his master, a professor, when he got off the train on his return from work. The professor died in 1925, but the dog lived on for 10 years more, loyally meeting the train every day at the usual time, and resisting all attempts to rehome him. A statue of him was set up in the station, even in his lifetime, and a special section of the concourse was set aside as his home. His stuffed body is now in the Natural Science Museum in Tokyo,
and his statue is always garlanded with flowers on the anniversary of his death. Want Gaspode, the modern, mangy, flea-bitten Gaspode, would make of these stories, is not hard to guess, considering his cynical ideas about his famous namesake.
"That's very sad," said Victor.
"Yeah, everyone says he demonstrates a dog's innocent and undying love for his master," said Gaspode, spitting the words out as if they were ashes.
"You don't believe that, then?"
"Not really. I believe any bloody dog will stay still and howl when you've just lowered the gravestone on his tail," said Gaspode.
The modern Gaspode takes good care to keep his skills hidden, which is relatively easy since most people refuse to believe that any dog can talk. Even so, rumours get around. William de Word, editor of the Ankh-Morpork Times, who is professionally inclined to scepticism, struggles in vain against that strange phenomenon, the urban myth. A couple of months ago, someone had tried to hand William the old story of there being a dog in the city that could talk. It was the third time this year. William had explained that it was an urban myth. It was always the friend of a friend who had heard the talk, and it was never anyone who had seen the dog. There seemed to be no stopping that kind of story. People swore there was some long-lost heir to the throne of Ankh living incognito in the town. William certainly recognized wishful thinking when he heard it. From the truth. Alas for William, who has chosen the wrong city in which to be an enlightened thinker. Meanwhile, other people, even more cynical, know how to take a legend and turn it into a nice little earner. One is the con man known as the Amazing Morris, who may in fact, according to rumour, be a remarkably cunning cat. He travels from town to town with his gang of educated rodents, who infiltrate the buildings. A musical confederate then undertakes, for a good fee, to summon them with his magic pipe, and lead them all far, far away. It has always worked. Here we know this as a rather inverted version of the Pied Piper story. Treacle Mines. Embedded in place names, lurking like hidden diamonds, are precious traces of past history and traditions. There is, for example, a street in Ankh-Morpork called Treacle Mine Road, running from Misbegot Bridge to Easy Street. It takes its name from the treacle mines which used to be worked in this area, which are ancient, very ancient indeed. The deepest levels contain the remnants of pig treacle measures that are estimated to be 500,000 years old, intermingled with basalt slabs carved with archaic trollish pictograms. The mines were abandoned many years ago, and most people believe that this was because they were exhausted. However, when some deep-down dwarfs, grags, bought property on that street and began mining below it, for reasons of their own, as told in Thud, they reopened old tunnels and galleries, and their bores struck some residue of deep treacle. Up in the mountains on the borders of Uberwald, there are still very productive treacle mines, enabling the dwarfs of that region to make a handsome profit, exporting both raw pig treacle and luscious treacle-based confectionery to the cities of the plain. Far away in the hot and swampy realm of Genua, there are lakes of liquid treacle fermenting happily only a little way underground, and occasionally bursting out under pressure to create springs of rum. Near Querm, there are toffee beds. The origin of all this succulence goes back to the dawn of time, when the fifth elephant collided with the disc, with so great an impact that thousands of acres of prehistoric wild sugarcane was buried under massive landslides, and compacted into a dense crystalline mass. Those who study the effects of cosmic resonance in space-time continuum of the multiverse often cite the treacle mine phenomenon with amazement and awe, for it has been shown without doubt that these mines, which are a plain fact of geography on the disc, have insinuated themselves into the folklore of a world where they do not actually exist, and never have done. In England, there are at least 30 villages reputed to have a secret treacle mine tucked away somewhere on their territory. Even more astonishing, there is one place, the village of Patcham in East Sussex, where people have a fairly accurate idea of how the trigger was formed, allowing for the fact that this world sadly lacks any cosmic elephants. A Mrs. Austin told the West Sussex Gazette in 1973 the tale she knew and had passed on to her children. Millions of years ago, when England was a tropical country, before the Ice Age, sugarcane grew here. Year after year it grew, ripened, and rotted unharvested, the molasses draining away down into the folds of the hills, where it accumulated above an impermeable layer of clay. The centuries passed, the colder weather came, and sugarcane no longer grew on the downs, but the underground layer of treacle lay patiently waiting, until in 1871, Peter Jones, a scientist who had long suspected its existence, sank the first shaft. The ensuing treacle gusher spouted for 3 days, covering the countryside for several miles around with a fine rain of treacle, until it was at last brought under control. Elsewhere, other explanations are offered. At Cobham, in Surrey, military incompetence is alleged to be the cause. It is said that soldiers who encamped on Cobham Common before setting out to the Crimean War, others say American troops stationed nearby during the First World War, buried vast stockpiles of supplies, including drums of treacle and molasses, and forgot to remove them when they left. The drums corroded, and a subterranean reservoir of treacle was formed. Other places do not attempt to account for the origin of the precious substance, but tell ingenious tales about its discovery and use. The mine at Jarvis Brook near Crowborough, Sussex, was supposedly begun by the Romans, who carved the solid treacle rock into jewellery, but never found out how sweet it was. This was discovered accidentally when a medieval baby prince was visibly soothed by sucking his mother's necklace. At Sabden, Lancashire, it is claimed that boggarts, a species of goblin, are employed in the mine to lick up any spilt treacle. Cards and souvenirs about the mine are sold to tourists. Yet, sad to say, the people who tell these tales do not take them seriously. It is all a poker-faced joke, a hoax, a leg pull, used by the locals to hoax gullible outsiders, by parents to entertain their children, by older children to make fools of young ones. While all the time, did they but know it, the remains of a real treacle mine lie below the streets of Ankh-Morpork. Wizardry and Ceremonial Magic. Any comment upon wizardry in a book with folklore in the title will have to be made very quietly, since there is nothing that infuriates a scholar more than to be mistaken for a member of the folk, after he has spent all his waking hours for the past 50 years with his nose in a book, mealtimes partially excepted. Naturally, he may have come across the odd scrap of folklore in the course of his reading, but he will make it very plain that he does not believe it. Arch-Chancellor Ridcully, for example, has heard of the kind of monster called a skiapod by ancient Greeks and a uniped in Latin, a humanoid with only a single leg and foot, this being so huge that if it lies on its back and sticks its leg in the air, the foot makes an excellent sunshade. But he thinks it's just something travel writers invented. "They always make up that sort of thing. Otherwise it's too boring. It's no good coming home and just saying you were shipwrecked for 2 years and ate winkles, is it? You have to put in a lot of daft stuff about men who go around on one big foot, and the land of giant plum puddings and nursery rubbish like that." From the Last Continent. Magic, as actually practiced by wizards, generally consists of transformation spells, the skilled hurling of fireballs, the creation of illusions, and the occasional summoning of demons. Or, in extreme cases, of death himself. These things are done as rarely as possible, but the theory underpinning these few simple acts is immense, and subdivided into innumerable branches. Divination, theurgy, runes ancient and modern, Kabbalistic rites, gramarye, knowledge of amulets and talismans, Magianism, thaumatology, astrology, morbid spellbinding, sortilege, invisible writing, and so on and so forth. Not necromancy, however. This is frowned upon, and has been replaced by a far more acceptable Department of Postmortem Communications. The very heart and soul of Unseen University is its library. With over 90,000 volumes of grimoires and magical texts, it is by far the largest concentration of magical scholarship anywhere in the multiverse, and so dangerous that most of the books have to be chained up. Folklore? Oral tradition? Old wives' tales? Ta! It is an insult to the grand intellectual achievements of wizardry to think their work has anything in common with the foolish ways of the peasantry. No doubt the famous and learned occultists of medieval and Renaissance Europe, such men as Albertus Magnus in the 13th century, or Paracelsus, Cornelius Agrippa, and Dr. John Dee in the 16th, would have been just as dismissive. They wrote books which straddled the ill-defined boundaries between magic, science, and philosophy. Massive, expensive tomes in Latin, the international language of the wise. Albertus, for instance, wrote a treatise on the practical procedures of alchemy, and was also reputed to be the author of a much simpler Book of Secrets, which described the magical properties of stones, herbs, and beasts. For example, if thou wilt know whether thy wife be chaste or no, take the stone which is called magnet, in English the lodestone. It is of a sad blue colour, and it is found in the Sea of Indy, and sometime in part of Almain. Lay this stone under the head of a wife, and if she be chaste, she will embrace her husband. If she be not chaste, she will fall forth of her bed. If thou wilt overcome thine enemies, take the stone which is called Draconites, from the dragon's head. And if the stone be drawn out from him alive, it is good against all poisons, and he that beareth it on his left arm shall overcome all his enemies. The marigold. The virtue of this herb is marvellous, for if it be gathered, the sun being in the sign Leo in August, and wrapped in the leaf of a laurel, or may tree, and a wolf's tooth added thereto, no man shall be able to speak one word against the bearer thereof, but only words of peace. If anything be stolen, and the bearer of the things before named shall lay them under his head in the night, he shall see the thief in a vision. And so on. It must remain one of the mysteries of transdimensional correspondence whether this Albertus Magnus of medieval Europe has any connection with Alberto Malik, the exceptionally powerful wizard who founded Unseen University some 2,000 years ago and disappeared while performing the Rite of Ashk Ent backwards. He had intended to achieve immortality, and so he did, in a way. He now exists, one can't quite say lives, as cook, valet, and gardener in the House of Death, which suits him nicely. On Earth, grimoires were often attributed to prestigious figures from legendary times, such as King Solomon the Wise and Hermes Trismegistus. As time went on, the practice of magic slid down the social scale. By the 18th and 19th centuries, cheap, simple books of spells and conjurations were selling in thousands to village cunning men and wise women, and to ordinary households. In Germany, there was the 6th and 7th books of Moses. In France, Le Grand Albert and Le Petit Albert, Le Dragon Rouge, La Poule Noire, and the splendidly named Abracadabra Monumentissima Diabolica. Intellectual wizardry was being drawn into the vast melting pot of folk tradition. This has not happened in Ankh-Morpork, nor is it likely to, so long as the librarian has an ook to say in the matter. Nevertheless, far outside the hallowed walls of Unseen University, lurking in shadowy and insalubrious back alleys, and keeping out of sight of qualified wizards, are magical practitioners of a lower sort. Their ambitions are great, their skills are not. They know far less than they suppose. They band together in secret societies with imposing titles and attach vast importance to ritual, ceremony, and magical tools. They are led by pompous, bullying men, calling themselves Supreme Grand Masters. Such are, for instance, the Elucidated Brethren of the Ebon Knight, guardians of the sacred knowledge since a time no man may wot of. Such groups would be just as indignant as the academic wizards at the notion that what they were doing had anything in common with folk magic. No, their Grand Master had been taught profound secrets from the heart of being, while undergoing tuition from hidden venerable sages on a distant mountain. Furthermore, the sages had given him a book of ancient wisdom. Actually, he had arranged for it to be stolen from the unseen university library, but no matter, it was a book, and it was ancient. But it would be a mistake to think that everyone in Ankh-Morpork has such a highbrow approach to magic. There are people who need no books, no apparatus, no complex rituals. People with a natural inborn talent for the occult, like the redoubtable medium Mrs. Evadne Cake, noted for her precognition and her numerous spirit contacts. In some ways, she is very like a witch, and every community needs its witch. Even in Unseen University itself, the housekeeper, Mrs. Whitlow, dabbles in the occult. She loves trying to peer into the future, and owns a crystal ball which she keeps under a sort of pink frilly tea cosy, several sets of divinatory cards, a pink velvet bag of runestones, a Ouija board, and special dried monkey turds, which can be thrown in such a way as to reveal all the secrets of the universe. Granny Weatherwax, for purposes of her own, offered Mrs. Whitlow her services as a reader of tea leaves. No doubt she had her own opinion of such amateurish goings-on, but she kept it to herself. Sator Square. Most of those who walk through the streets of Ankh-Morpork never pause to wonder why the square in front of Unseen University is named Sator Square. There is indeed a reason, though you have to search the annals of a different universe to discover it. On Earth, Sator Square is the most famous of all magic squares. But it's no use looking for it on the street map of any city, for it is not that sort of square. It is a palindromic word square. These are talismans, difficult to invent, but very powerful. You have to choose a group of words which can be laid out as a square of letters, and which, this is the hard bit, will remain the same whether you read it downwards, upwards, from the left, or from the right. Most of them are mere gibberish, but the Sator formula does make sense of a sort. It goes, Sator, Arapo, Tenet, Opera, Rotas. Four out of the five are normal Latin words, meaning the sower holds the works and the wheels. But Arapo is either pure nonsense or the mysterious mystical name of the mysterious mystical sower who controls the wheels of fate, of the heavenly spheres. The earliest known example of the square is in one of the houses of Pompeii, buried by the eruption of Vesuvius in AD 79. Another early one was found scratched on wall plaster in a Roman villa at Cirencester in Gloucestershire. At these dates, both homes could have belonged to Christian families, and the square could have served as a coded signal of their faith. It can hardly be a coincidence that its letters can be unpacked to reveal the first words of the Our Father. Pater Noster, twice over, plus A and O twice. The latter could mean Alpha and Omega, the beginning and the end, which is a title of Christ in the Apocalypse, the Bible's book of Revelation. What's more, the whole thing can be laid out as a cross. The Sator Arapo Square was known all over medieval Europe, and in some countries, Russia, America and Germany, for example, was still being used in folk magic right up to modern times, almost 2,000 years after it was invented. People said it would put out a fire if you wrote it on a piece of wood and threw the wood into the flames. If you cut it into dough, baked it, and swallowed it, it would cure the bite of a mad dog. In the United States in the 19th century, a cheap book of spells recommended it as a fire precaution, a detector of witches, a protection against disease, and good for the cows. Some echo of all this must surely have filtered through to the Wizards of Unseen University, but whether they actually use word squares themselves remains unknown. The Black School. For centuries, Earth has known rumours of a black school, where magic was taught, though none quite matches the venerable antiquity of the disc's unseen university, now some 2,000 years old. The only possible contenders would be certain secret academies, where, if we can believe the rather unreliable Roman author Pomponius Mela, in the 1st century AD, druids trained pupils for 20 years on end, in sequestered and remote places, whether in a cave or in secluded groves. Once real universities became established in the Middle Ages, there soon grew up the legend of their secret counterpart, a college called the Black School, where one could learn all the occult arts. It was deep underground, windowless, and pitch dark. Nobody ever saw the teacher, for that was the devil himself. Students never went outside. Every evening they would say aloud what they wanted to learn, and by next morning the right books would have appeared magically on their desks, written in fiery letters that glowed in the dark, or the information would be written in fire upon the walls. And when the course of studies ended, the students would rush to escape through the single door, for it was known that the devil would take the hindmost, unless he was cunning enough to trick him into seizing his cloak, or his shadow instead. And where was this wondrous black school? Usually it was said to be in one of the great medieval universities, but not, of course, in one's own country. The learned French scholar and scientist Gerbert d'Aurillac, 946-1003, who became Pope Sylvester II, was rumoured to have studied magic at the Islamic University in Cordoba, Spain. The Icelander, Sæmundur the Learned, 1056-1133, was said to have attended a black school somewhere in France. In Romania, folk tradition tells of an underground academy called Scolomance near Sibiu, in the mountains of Transylvania. Bram Stoker had heard of this. Others have talked of a black school in Paris, Padua, Salamanca, Prague, or Wittenberg. Faust studied there. Probably students at Wittenberg and Prague whispered about the fearful occult activities at Oxford and Cambridge. An aside. It has been suggested by the learned science fiction writer Isaac Asimov that the general Western antipathy towards witches is at least partly to do with teeth and beards. The hypothesis runs like this. Until the advent of modern dentistry, people who lived to a great age tended to lose their teeth, to get gummy, in fact. For the old widow, perhaps with no family to care for her, that added another problem. She looked like a crone, with the lower part of her face dished in and the nose appearing to hook. Of course, the same thing happened to the old men, but they could grow long white beards to hide the wrinkles behind and looked as wise as an Old Testament prophet. Wise wizard, wicked witch. What a difference a razor makes.